So I told the staff last night I live on a little island in Puget Sound called Fox Island. We familiarly call it Dixieland because our former governor, Dixie Lee Ray, lives on Fox Island. She's a fabulous, brilliant woman, and I really consider it kind of a privilege to know that she's a resident of the island, that I share that little bit with her. My work over the years has been essentially in schools. For many years, I was a teacher, a vice principal, and principal of Clover Park High School in the Tacoma area. Following that, I served as headmaster of a private girls' boarding school, the Annie Wright School in Tacoma. And following that, I went to work for the state superintendent of public instruction as an administrator of private education, those laws that relate to private schools, which represents some of the, I think, interesting conversation and dialogue that we might develop regarding issues of legislation, politics, Constitution, First Amendment, and so forth in the next few days. I retired from public service about 5 years ago and became president of the Washington Federation of Independent Schools, which is an association of private schools in the state of Washington, made up of Catholic, Lutheran, Independent, Montessori, preschools, homeschools, the whole array of private schools in the state of Washington. I do the same thing in the state of Oregon on a much lesser basis. And in that capacity, in both those capacities, I serve as a consultant in lobbying activities in Oregon and serve as a principal lobbyist for private schools in the state of Washington and Olympia. In that, working with private schools and public schools, that has created a certain tension, but also a very interesting relationship. The interesting fact that I also served as president of the Washington Education Association in 1957-58, many years ago, so I've had both that relationship in the political arena, and therefore spent a good deal of time in Olympia and over the past 35 years and some time in Washington, D.C. As a result of that, I've become very interested in constitutional issues, and this I felt was a very, very good summer for me because of the bicentennial of the United States Constitution, in which our dear founding fathers in May joined in Philadelphia and decided to, in a sense, amend the Articles of Confederation. But when they got there, or in the process of getting there, starting the work, they wrote a new Constitution. And I'll try and deal with some of that in the next session. I think I would like to do a little foundation work, share a little literature, and some of the things I'd like to do. I have a few pieces of literature I'll bring today and some on Thursday, and you're welcome to take them. I'll share them with you. I'm not sure where the bookstore got the principal book that I wanted to use. But I thought I dealt at one time in doing some consulting work for some evangelicals in Washington when we were looking at tax exemption issues, because when you deal with the church in the political arena, you are going to deal with tax exemptions. And one of the interesting things, I think, in the legislative and political process, frankly, are the inconsistencies that you have to deal with. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the inconsistencies that happen in dealing with the Constitution and in the political process. That also constitutes part of the fun. But in working with these evangelicals in the Seattle area, and we're now the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. I like that best about our name, is that I like the idea of evangelism. I think that's one of our most important, if not our most important, tasks. I forget who was talking today about, I go back to the days even as far back as the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and I remember the convention that changed the name from the Norwegian Lutheran Church to the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and then we became the American Lutheran Church, and so forth and so on. But there's some lady in Minnesota who was terribly upset when they moved to took out the name Norwegian Lutheran Church, because she was absolutely convinced that God would not understand the prayers if they were not in Norwegian. It was just a... So anyway, we have to change, but I like the name Evangelical Lutheran Church, and I like to think that politicians are often very evangelical, and lobbyists sometimes more so. In this reference, and we started doing this little exercise before, I'm not going to take a lot of time, but I wanted to give some kind of sequence from Genesis through Revelation that I think gives us some foundations upon which we determine the rationale and why we ought to really be moving in the political process as Christians. Now, Genesis 1:26, can you tell me Genesis 1:26? Someone's already told me, but come on, just tell us again and we'll go at it. Jerry's the best. Yeah, in other words, when God created story of creation, he created man and then said, listen, it's your earth, I'm giving you dominion over everything in it. And so we get into some interesting questions, and one of the most recent cases decided at the Supreme Court level, I won't give a lot of time to that right now, was the case that came out of Louisiana on creation science and evolution. And we'll talk a little bit about the terminology that relates to that, because my feeling is that, you know, just an initial reaction to that is that the Supreme Court, in its wisdom as they pull these people together, I think it's made a pretty profound decision relative to this issue. Now, the reason I think that, and then we'll have some debates on this when you get along, because there are amazing things. When you use the term creation science, I think you add a dimension that may be beyond what it's all about. I think there is a story of creation. We might even say there's a theory of creation. But I think the great questions come, is creation a science? Is it a science? Evolution is a theory, which is, in my estimation, not completely founded. I don't think there's enough evidence yet, and I'm not a scientist. I better wait for Alden to come in or someone who can answer that question for us. But anyway, the Supreme Court now, with conservative jurists have ruled, even though the two most conservative Supreme Court justices, Rehnquist, who is a LCA Lutheran, and Scalia, who is a very good Catholic, both wrote the minority opinion on this 7-2 decision. So that means that there wasn't necessarily have Powell to swing the vote. It was a very clear-cut decision on that issue. And if you remember the school prayer issue, which I didn't bring up, I bring that up in some other point, which is another very interesting decision in which I would happen to concur with the U.S. Supreme Court justices on the issue, which I think was, what was that one? I think that was probably 9. How was that tight? I'll look it up. I have it there. But... I think that was true. In other words, to take a prescribed written prayer, impose that on a captive school audience, in my mind, is probably not constitutional. And yet again, I don't think what happens on these kinds of issues is everyone begins, when that kind of decision is to make, to polarize their discussions on it and to give their arguments, I think, on the wrong basis. And the school prayer issue was, I don't know anybody in the school who can't pray when they want to, but the only problem is don't hand a child a prayer and say, this is my prayer, and now it's going to be yours. So I think we'll talk a little bit about that in the session, maybe. I'll leave that one at the moment. Exodus, what's Exodus 21:18? Why do you think I put that on there? That's the Ten Commandments. I think the Ten Commandments have become the basis of law, at least as we know it in terms of the English tradition. The Supreme Court, the only reason I put the Supreme Court there is because they have the Ten Commandments, every time they sit and write a hear a case or think about a decision, they have the Ten Commandments posted where they sit in the Supreme Court. It has to be one of the inconsistencies occasionally that I'll bring up as go along. But because you can't hang the Ten Commandments in a public schoolroom, and you can't start the school day with a prayer, but every legislature in America pays a chaplain, and they pay the U.S. chaplain very well to lead prayer as they open the session of the Congress and legislature. Matthew 22:15-22, of course, a famous where we get all of our church-state decisions. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and unto God that which is God's. For God. The First Amendment of the Supreme Court, of course, has probably the it's called the fundamental rights that exist. And the first one, of course, was to take care of that issue that relates to the establishment of the church. And I could spend a little time on the history and the development of that through the religious statute for Virginia, essentially written by Jefferson and Madison, who were also then prominent Madison particularly in writing the United States Constitution, sitting through the sessions at the Philadelphia Convention and keeping some of the best journals that were kept in that time. Jefferson was in France and I have a quote from Jefferson, I think writing from France to Madison, but the establishment issue has been one major share of the cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court. In fact, most of those cases up to this time have been establishment issues, and now in more recent years you've had generally the freedom to worship issues have been the ones that have taken a little more prominence. We might be able to talk about a few of those. But the one case Tennessee on the textbook, secular humanism, I wanted to spend one day talking about what is religion and talk about secular humanism as a religion, because Judge Hand of the U.S. Court in Alabama says it's a religion, and he's written a very long decision on that fact. Now we'll see whether or not it goes up to the Supreme Court, which is the supreme law of the land, to determine what they feel about that textbook decision and or the secular humanism decision. And we can talk about that process a little bit, but I'm not here essentially. I'd rather deal with some other political process issues. Then Romans 13:1-14, which has created a lot of worldwide problems in terms of what preachers and theologians and have felt about that issue. But what's Romans 13? We won't read that chapter. Someone want to quote it? Or just assess essentially what it is? People are subject to government authority. Governments are created and ordained by God. And therefore, if they're ordained by God, what they say is God intends. And we'll talk a little bit about maybe some transcendent ideas about that, but Romans 13 has created some kinds of problems for, I think it's created some problems in South Africa as it relates to some of those issues early on, some of the literature that talks about people, oppressed people who may have assumed, you know, God's inspiration as spoke to Paul in writing that letter, that, you know, then if they are subject and therefore have not raised the kinds of voices that needed to be raised at the time. However, Acts 5:27-32, and that one is another area. I think it puts in about the common good out of Romans 13, that there is some need for order and so forth, of common good. But what is Acts 5:27-32? In that framework, there is when Peter and his associates were in prison, and they let him out, remember, and said, "You're not to speak." He said they'd have to do what what God had said. They have to obey God rather than men, and that's created some problems in the more fundamentalist Christian community, and for us at the school level, and also at the national level, in terms of legislation that would govern private fundamentalist Christian schools. And you'll find those groups essentially. Remember the Nebraska case, the horror story of Nebraska, where they took the preacher and to jail and padlocked his church and so forth. It was really one of the horror stories of America, other than there are some others like that that we could cite too, in which some people did not have constitutional protection. But that, if you go to Washington or Oregon and find the great increase in Christian school education in America has been in the fundamentalist Christian church, using a very specific curricula that speak to very, very fundamental Christian issues. I've visited their schools and been with them a lot, and I've seen what they do with their children. If they have good teachers and good materials, they do a very good job. They, interestingly enough, some of them have some very good contests in Bible memory, and I've thought a few times it wasn't bad. They were memorizing some awfully good things, and so I kind of appreciated that. But in the state of Washington, for instance, here where we are, and in Oregon, in Washington in particular, we have a mandatory approval law. In other words, the law requires that private schools meet certain approval standards. We still have 150 private fundamentalist Christian schools who don't register with the state, enrolling 3,000 or 4,000 students, because they believe that they obey God rather than men, or even the government. They don't buy into Romans 13, as I tell them. they have said that they believe the responsibility they have is to their children. That's church responsibility. But all I out of Revelations 1-5 was that Christ still is the ruler of the kings of the world. And if we begin to fear that, I'd like to talk a little bit, maybe if I can, on some of the thoughts on transformation. I'd like to look at a book called, some of you may have already seen it, The Different Drum, by Scott Peck. And he says, and the only part in there that I like, he talks about government, and he really talks about the United States government and really transformation, a transforming of what we're doing, which is probably good thought. The text that I was going to use, and I don't know if the bookstore got it or not, was Religion in American Public Life. It's written by James Reichle. It's really quite a good book. It's published by, he's an associate with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Brookings is a more liberal, has been, as compared to the American Enterprise Institute, which would have a more conservative view. And this book, though, is, in my mind, has a very, very good treatment of religion in American public life. And I'll just briefly cover. The religious issue is defined, the problem is defined, and a religion, politics, and human values. And there's a typology of this system. I just took that particularly because I thought it was kind of good, and I won't be able to take a lot of it. But divided into 7 possible value systems. Egoism, based on the individual self alone. Authoritarianism, based on society alone. Monism, based on transcendence alone. Idealism, based on transcendence and society in combination. Personalism, based on transcendence and the self in combination. And then civil humanism, which is a term I wanted to get to, based on the self and society in combination. We'll talk about the concept of civil or secular humanism. And then theist humanism, based on all 3 sources, transcendence, the self, and society. And if someone would like to take a look at this, they're welcome to do that in the next day or two, because I won't be able to cover it all. But they do have something about the churches and political action. They have interpreting the First Amendment, talk a little bit about But they have one section also on black activism, since this is Rainbow on the Mountain Week, or the Rainbow 2-week period here. I thought it might be interesting if someone wanted to look at that, because I would like to talk in the final session about those people who are going to make the difference and who might be making the difference in the process. And I think certainly I have the writing that Thurgood Marshall did on the Constitution is a rather interesting statement. And then I think the emergence of Jesse Jackson as a political power and his agenda, I think, is fantastic. I don't, particularly for social action and for education. I mean, he has something to say. He's the only one I think it has what I consider to be a very dynamic, powerful agenda for those kinds of things. I'm getting a new appreciation for Jesse Jackson, what he has to say. But I think that that might be an interesting look at that. So anyway, now on to now it's quiz time. Could I have someone's watch? I'll try not to steal. I'm going to have to be careful to stay within the bounds. I want you to. I can take another few minutes before we go. I'll give you on the Constitution. I like just to give a little brief, so we have a little understanding of the Constitution. Here is your first quiz question. These are developed by John DeYoung, who's an editorial writer for the Seattle PM. Which of the following are from the United States Constitution? Got this? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All men are created equal. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. The consent of the governed, of the people, by the people, and for the people. Start with the first one. What do you want to say? Just one answer?
Who said no?
None. Right. Now, if I could give you the statistics on the way the American people answered those questions, but it's fascinating. But I mean, you know, we really don't know. I mean, we're not that, none of us are that great on it. But it is interesting, because I really think if you're going to get in to the, you know, the political arena, you really have to know what the Constitution says, because I'll tell you, down in Olympia and Washington, D.C., they will chew you up fast, as a lobbyist I know. Because you need to know the Washington State Constitution, you need to know the amendments, you need to know its balance with the United States Constitution. But anyway, the life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal, the consent of the governed, come from what? The Declaration of Independence, written by our good founder, Thomas Jefferson. Then, of course, it's not hard from each according to his abilities, each according to his needs. Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. And of the people, by the people, for the people. Gettysburg Address. Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Ooh, this Holden found this written time. Now, the second quiz, since you've done so well, you're not ready for your SATs. this is a true or false one. All 13 states were represented in the convention of 1787, starting in May. No, who was that? Who was absent? Rhode Island. Who said that? The Narnia director. Boy, I'm confident for my children now. I am really. Gee. The Constitution was signed by the 55 men attending the convention. Well, they weren't. And I don't know which of the 55 signed, but a lot of them went home. I mean, it dragged in the summer. And it was hot, and the mosquitoes were biting. And it was terrible. And that little room, why, they really, bad. But the book, the best book I think on that probably is A Miracle of Philadelphia by Catherine Drinker Bowen. Is it Catherine Bowen Drinker? No, Catherine Drinker Bowen. She's really written a good picture. In our area right now, the Bremerton Sun is writing a day-by-day account of what happened, and they give kind of the vignettes of what happened day by day, and where Washington went to lunch and dinner, and where Ben Franklin stopped by for a drink, and where, you know, the whole ball of wax, and it's really kind of fascinating. And I've got some of them. I don't think did I bring them? No, I forgot. And I'll let someone just take those, and maybe someone likes to just mark them and pull out something that they might want to bring to us, because I've taken probably 30, 40 days out of there. And then the Constitution signed in 1787 did not contain the Bill of Rights, true or false? True. That was very controversial. The Bill of Rights was adopted when? 1791, 4 years later. But that was very controversial, and Jefferson was very upset. He was terribly upset because he felt that there you needed to establish that early on in terms of the Bill of Rights. All of the American states were required to ratify the Constitution. True or false? False. How many? Nine out of 13. And they had a tough time getting it. I mean, it wasn't that easy. It was tough. I'm not going to. I'd like to talk a little bit more about this book. If it is in the bookstore, it's good for a person that wants to have really a nice time with some of those early issues. I was really impressed with the book, and I marked it up a bit. And if someone would like to take it and read it, they can. Let me just say what do all of you? Oh, I know. I thought it was kind of interesting in politics. You've read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, Wormwood is having a tough time with this guy he's trying to change, the devil's nephew, working on it. But he had something interesting on politics and the theology and politics, because he found that probably the best attack was on the borderline between theology and politics, and so he says. To Wormwood in his letter, trying to see if he can change this guy, because the girl is having such a wonderful Christian influence on his life, as we know it can happen. And so we could do this by clearing away later perversions and then contrasting them with the whole Christian tradition in terms of theology. In the last generation, we promoted the construction of such a historical Jesus on liberal and humanitarian lines. Now we are putting forward a new historical Jesus along with Marxism, and revolutionary thinking. And he says the advantage of these constructions, which we intend to change every 30 years or so, are manifold. In the first place, they all tend to direct a people's devotion to something which does not exist, for each historical Jesus is unhistorical. I'll come to that in a little bit, but I enjoy him. But that leads me into another part, Richard John Neuhaus, out of the Lutheran Standard. Did you read the Lutheran Standard? Did you read that article? I thought it was quite good, because I think it talks more about the transformation, transcendence that we may get to by Saturday. But he wrote on religious freedom after 200 years of the American experiment, because that, there's no question that's a very critical point that I think we need to deal with. Here, and we certainly need to deal with the work that I'm doing. But no, the American covenant does not transcend all other covenants. The Christian's first and absolute loyalty is to the covenant community of the new Israel, the church, which is not a natural bond, but is brought into being by the grace of God in Christ. Now, in any political order, therefore, we Christians are alien citizens. As the early church's theologians put it, we are citizens to be sure, but we are alien citizens because we acknowledge a prior and higher claim by another sovereignty. And I only take that in line with what I don't think it's going to be a transition that I wanted. But I just want to talk about that because at some point we're going to have to, when we look at our political process and we look at our form of government, we look at our constitution, we look at our Bill of Rights, we look at everything, I think when we get to a different drum, when we see what Scott Peck has to say, we've got to look at a whole new order. And I think the last few days, the last day, last evening, with Will's preaching, this morning with our Bible study with Jack, this afternoon with our talking about the Hispanic Americans, and this afternoon with Alden talking about climate and environment. Boy, we have an agenda that's powerful, and all of which leads to what we have in our minds and hearts, spirit, as Christians in the political process. I'm going to now, because I think I want to set kind of an agenda for people who are going to be here for a period of time, but also to take care of the questions tonight. Let me also quote something from Jefferson. Dumas Malone has a 6-volume set on Jefferson's works, and one of which I looked at, one chapter. I can't remember the chapter. I put it in my bibliography. I can't remember the chapter it was. But Jefferson, Malone says about Jefferson, the earth belongs always to the living generation. That's been an interesting debate now between the constructionists and those who are working to think of it as a living. I think it's a living document, and we have talks of constitution conventions and things like that. But that takes legislation too. Believing that he could be no idolater of any constitution, his genius was not merely that of freedom and reasonableness. It was also the genius of experiment and change. Well, when you get today now, the literature, if you read the papers today, that's what they're talking about in terms of debate. I thought we might even conduct a little brief hearing on the Bork appointment one day, because it might give us some thoughts on that debate that's going on now in terms of that. Paige Smith, in volume 3, a set of volumes that Paige Smith is writing, a scholar in, who's Paige Smith? Dartmouth? No, I can't remember. Shaping of America. In any event, it should be evident by now that philosophical and theological considerations aside, the Constitution as a practical political document was achieved by the narrowest of margins. It came by tough. And then if we wanted to talk about some of the problems relate to what people are saying currently of what happened in terms of, I was thinking particularly of discrimination. See how we treat the poor and oppressed, the problems of education. Then this issue tonight with Alden, climate, environment, quality of life, the total of that picture, and what we're going to do. So one of these days, I hope we can have a legislative session and propose the kinds of things that might make a difference. The one book, I'll just review briefly, and then maybe a little bit more later, but The Different Drum by Scott Peck. I've just got it, and I'm so impressed. A psychiatrist who went to work for the U.S. government found himself so absolutely frustrated, he finally left. And as he left, I'm sure he didn't know whether he could go at it again, but he has written some very interesting comments on government. And what we need to do, the total book is, of course, about community making. And we are doing some discussions on staff, I think, are we not? On another, on community? Is that reviewing a book in that area? I can't remember if that's what he was talking about then. And then the one area that he talks about is the presidency, because the thing of the three branches, the executive, the legislative, and judicial. He talks Toward a Community Presidency. I think that's a fascinating, fascinating section of the book. Have you read that, Jack? Let me take this. Make some comments on it. But it is very, very interesting. We'll talk about that more. Now, tell me some questions or some ideas you have about anything that we might have discussed at this point. We'll talk a little bit about foundations, the Constitution, spend a little more time in the Supreme Court and some of those decisions later. We'll take a day for legislative processes, and then maybe deal with some of the political realities if you want to talk about that now, too. Okay. Have I generated? I do to some extent in the state of Washington. I think I can tell you, when it relates to school issues, what would stand the test of the state constitution, the state Supreme Court. A little tougher time when it comes to the United States Supreme Court. And of course, I come back in most of those areas to the that relates to help, since my business is school business, and I essentially represent a private school interest. I find some inconsistencies between states on what they will do. For instance, the state of Minnesota, and so I'll take assistance to private church-related schools. Very controversial issue in America. Tuition tax credits, tuition tax deductions, educational vouchers, loans, so forth. Now, private colleges and universities have had little or no problem when it came to receiving federal money for building, student loans, you know, you can almost name it. Now, if you apply that to the elementary secondary school, it is almost nil. So in a few programs, you might have some chapter programs. The great legislation of 1965, Lyndon Johnson, the start of the massive increase of federal funding of elementary secondary education in America. Needed, no question, and more is needed. I have no question about the need for education. I think education needs to be basically restructured, but nonetheless, it doesn't mean that you should hurt kids because by withholding the kind of funds that are needed to give proper instruction. But when it comes to higher education, they've always been able to borrow money and to provide them. I think that should be done at the elementary secondary level for parents who choose other than public institutions. I think that's one inconsistency. Another inconsistency is the property tax exemption, which is one in which we say we're not going to help kids. There's no constitutional basis for providing a tax exemption in our country for churches or nonprofit organizations. That's either been done legislatively or by precedents. So as a result of that, churches, private church-related schools, are given tax exemptions unless under other kinds of legislation they should discriminate on any basis. And I don't think they probably should have that. I think that's for the common good of all of our people. So I believe that has been and they try, they're working on that. They would like to, if there's a way, money is needed, and legislators and congressmen will seek ways to justify applying a tax. And so our private church-related schools frequently are in the midst of a controversy regarding having to pay a particular kind of tax, whether it's a sales tax, a business occupation tax, or something that should be on a non-taxable type of thing. But the property tax exemption has been one area which I think has been some inconsistency. There is in most state constitutions and in the United States Constitution, those rights not reserved for the federal government, then the states can make their own decisions about that. So as the history of our country developed, as you moved westward in our country, that's the same is true of Canada. In Nova Scotia, full support for private church-related schools. In British Columbia, it was 5 years ago, they finally got a tuition tax credit for parents sending their children to private church-related schools. In the United States, there's much more support for private church-related schools in the eastern part of the United States than there is in the western. And that's because in the late 19th century, when our states were formed in this part of the United States, Senator Blaine in the late 19th century was very opposed at the congressional level to providing any funds for Catholic parochial schools, essentially. And so as the states moved westward, there was a very restrictive clause placed in a lot of the states that constituted, particularly the state of Washington, one of the most restrictive clauses that exists in the United States, in which it says no public money shall be expended for religious worship, instruction, or exercise. Now, my feeling is that is not constitutional. But I mean, that's Finville stating. That doesn't mean anything. I think we could raise a case. I have a young lawyer in Tacoma, a very bright young guy, who says, well, that is a worthy case, but to spend the money, it's so expensive to take something through the judicial process. And so even though our Constitution says, the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land, nonetheless, there is an element in there which makes it more restrictive than the supreme law of the land, which is, that's an inconsistency, I believe. The state of Minnesota, which is an example of a state in the Northwest Ordinance, became a state sooner than the state of Washington, provides a tuition tax credit for public and private school parents, about $1,300 or $1,400 at the secondary level, and about $700 or $800 at the elementary school level, for public and private school parents. Public school parent has an expenditure, then he can deduct it from the state income tax. For the state of Washington, the private school community, I can't speak for the board or anything else, might be interested in the tuition tax if that's constitutional. In other words, if speaking from my standpoint as representing a private school interest, not exclusive from some of the other discussions, I'd be an advocate of helping parents make choices, and that's where I find some inconsistency in that program. We have a strong debate on that between the public and private school community. The other would be in simple things like the coin carrying in God We Trust. I think that's an infringement on the Establishment Clause, interpreted in some areas the way it's interpreted. I think it is also true in the case of the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. I think One Nation Under God is inappropriate under that, if you were to take that amendment. I think maybe the employment of chaplains in the military service. In other words, you pay for a religious ceremony, you build chapels and you pay chaplains. So, God forbid that we would ever change that. But I'm just saying, if you want to deal in inconsistencies, why I feel that's an inconsistency. And I don't. What I believe that we need to look at maybe what Supreme Court Justice William Douglas said. We are a religious people. And he wrote that many years ago, and therefore I believe that our country is a country of religious people, and that there's a big tent, and we would be better off to make sure that we are very tolerant of religious positions, and maybe even supportive of them, as long as it does not offend another religious minority or group. And in public schools, that's where we have to be very, very conscious of that responsibility. But I don't believe it means necessarily withholding from a parent who cannot make a choice that opportunity to make that choice. The choice of schools now, both public and private, is more a socioeconomic choice and a real estate choice than a real choice. And so legislation to generate that possibility. We can talk about the common good, because there's an argument on the other side that we need a citizenry that is literate in a common body of knowledge and experience. I don't believe that negates that requirement in a school situation. May not be public supported. I read a letter in a National Education Week that said there was really no basis upon which there was any reason to fund a national public school system any more so than a private one. In other words, if you can't fund a private education system to the common good, is there any reason to support a public one? There are the reasons why we need to do it. That's what some editorial writer wrote. A fellow by the name of a professor of law at the University of Massachusetts, Stephen Ahrens, has written an interesting book on called Compelling Belief. And he raises an interesting question and argues Supreme U.S. Supreme Court case that argued effectively for the right of parents to choose private schools, a Society of Sisters versus Pierce in Oregon, which is the most famous case that relates to that, parents' right to choose a school. And that case was decided on a 14th Amendment due process basis. Whereas Stephen Ahrens has written a very interesting article some years ago, his new book is on Compelling Belief, but some years ago, on arguing from a First Amendment basis on the freedom to choose rather than the establishment or the due process. But the concern that many of us have is for the urban center, which in other words, people moved out to suburbs. They went out to the suburbs, and then the Catholic and Lutheran Protestant Reformed school systems left. I mean, they couldn't retain them, and there was no funds to do it. The parishes couldn't do it. They moved to good suburban areas, and as a result of that, it decimated the Catholic school population, which decreased between 1965 and 1975 by about 2 or 3 million students. And from 75 to 85, you had this fundamentalist Christian growth that re-established that number and increased the private school percentage by a percent or two in the last decade. But those I guess are some of the inconsistencies. I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I'm not a able to do that, but I've read enough now in it, I think, to look at those areas. I'm not sure, quite sure what the answer is, though. It's legislated, and it's then mounting an effort on our part to see that.
Are you familiar?
Not too familiar with that, Jack. You could explain it. You go into that. I'm not really as familiar with that as I would be with some of the school issues. Go ahead.
No, I don't know. I'm just curious.
It's like President Roosevelt when it may be similar to the time of President Roosevelt incarcerated all the Japanese Americans.
That's what I was going, that done under a provision of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, presidential authority. It's emergency, a national emergency. Yeah, he has there's an interesting power, but that that's what like Scott Peck so well. Scott Peck does an interesting thing in discussing the presidency, in which he believes that the president should serve essentially two functions: that of leadership and mobilizing that leadership, and that we would know ahead of time. Someone else would take care of that kind of responsibility, so the people could respond to it by some initiative. That's the other thing too. There's no way to change the United States Constitution other than by an amendment, which has to be ratified by 2/3 of the states, or a constitutional convention. A lot of people are afraid of a constitutional convention because they feel it would open up a whole bag of worms, which would still is one way. There have been people calling for that for a long, long time. And they might do what the fellows did in 1787. They might rewrite it, which could, you know, that could have a lot of good things in it, too. That might be one of the initiatives that we would have out of the process, political process. But that's interesting. Power of the president. But see, they pull him back. I mean, look at Watergate. I mean, the president assumed some powers. He said some things and did some things, but Congress, that's the checks and balances we have are really pretty good. That's the other thing I've always felt, too, and relative to your question. I do believe that Congress has the power to intervene at any time under its legislative authority. Yes. Yeah. Well, the Boland Amendment was badly written, otherwise it might have worked. Boland Amendment was... Well, it was a good amendment. It wasn't well written. But the thing is that the Congress has the power to do that. That's why I talk about the balanced budget. We talk about deficits. The president writes a budget, but I mean the legislative branch has the power to adopt it, change it, override a veto, or what have you. As they what was the reason they recently overrode the president on the other issue? Pardon? Yeah, the highway, which in some ways that bothered me a great deal because it was insignificant compared to the $200 billion of debt that they went into. That was bothering me.
You can't use the Watergate in doing
contingency
acts.
Oh, no, I'm just...
You're dealing with legislative...
The better to deal with the Iron Gate. Iran would be a better one to deal with because I think some powers were assumed by the office of the president. But we still don't know what to do.
The congressional acts will not help unless you increase the budget on a lot of things. Once you said we're under a state of emergency, that's what Roosevelt
That's right.
War.
I have some issues like that cited in some other material I have here, and I don't know if I'll get to it or not, but I remember there were four or five areas like that, Jack. I'll have to look back in my notes and see if
anything
I can
on that, I would appreciate
it. If I can find it, I'll try and get it back to you.
Probably about time for the
hustle.
Move on to the...
Thank you. Oh, Alden. Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Hey, Carl.
Phil.
Tracy's the Court of Appeals that Tracy is working with. Heard that, or I talked to her about that case in Alabama.
What's that? Right.
Yeah. And she said, well, they were able to stay that judge is a maverick. They hope that he'll retire.
I know it, but they'll take that Supreme Court.
No, I don't think so.
You don't think
so? No. She said that she didn't think it would because
you want to take that tonight?
It would be a waste of time.